hominy. If a person thinks that he has offered his zuhr or noon prayer, and after this, so he tends to his asr prayer or afternoon prayer, so he's busy offering it. While offering his afternoon or asr prayer, all right, he remembers that he made a mistake, so he offered his zuhr or noon prayer.
Mm-hmm.
All right?
Yes.
What is he supposed to do? Should he, stop praying and do something else? Or, re-offer his prayer? What?
If he thinks he has already offered the zuhr prayer, yes?
Yes.
He realizes.
Yes.
Because I think there are two scenarios.
Yes.
Once you offer the zuhr prayer.
Yes.
And you think, and in the middle of the prayer, you realize that you have already offered the zuhr prayer. Now, in this case, you cannot.
Like you are busy offering the asr prayer right now.
Uh huh.
And then you remember that you made a mistake.
Okay.
All right. So what happens here?
So you should, if you're busy offering your asr prayer,
yes.
Okay, that's the main point, you
yes.
know. So in that case, you have to change your niyyah to dhuhr, because you haven't offered the dhuhr prayer, okay?
Yes.
If you're busy offering your asr prayer, and all of a sudden you remember that you haven't offered the dhuhr prayer, of
yes.
course, you have to change your niyyah to dhuhr. To dhuhr. And it's not necessary to break
stop,
your
prayer. Or break the prayer.
To break your prayer or to stop the prayer.
And begin.
And begin offering the prayers all over again. You know,
mm-hmm.
That's not necessary. So it's a matter of changing your niyyah. Because you change your niyyah from asr to dhuhr.
Even if it happens like at the end of the prayer?
Yeah, that's something else. If there's no time left, and the time left only is sufficient for asr prayer. In that case, you should continue offering the asr prayer, because if you
uh-huh.
if you do not do so, you will miss both the asr prayer as well as the dhuhr prayer.
Uh-huh.
So that is the specific time. In the specific time, such a change
no, no,
of
no, if there is a still time actually within the prescribed time
uh-huh.
for any kind of prayer, and you are busy offering the asr prayer,
yeah,
you suddenly remember that you thought
yeah.
that you
yeah
well
that
you,
you
offered
had the you had
zuhr.
You had offered
yeah.
the dhuhr prayer, but then you come to the point to the conclusion that you had not offered
exactly.
and you realize that you did not offer,
but you realize it at the end of the asr prayer.
Oh, that it doesn't
but
matter.
There is still time,
even if you are on the fourth rakat,
right.
Okay, and before let's say. Now, there's another thing which we need to learn, because let's say Maghrib and Isha prayer, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Maghrib and Isha. Maghrib consists of 3 rak'ah, and Isha consists of 4 rak'ah, okay?
Right.
Now, if you are on the 4th rak'ah, what are you supposed to do? Of course,
yes, exactly.
Before the ruku of the 4th rak'ah, if you have not done the ruku of the
uh-huh.
4th rak'ah, you should sit down and change your niyyah to Maghrib
yes.
and complete the prayer.
I see.
And of course, there is you need to do
say tashahud and wassalam.
Yeah, say tashahud, and of course you should perform 2 sajda of sahv, because you have done an extra. You have stood there.
Uh-huh. Because of the standing.
Because
you have
of
to,
standing,
yeah.
because of unnecessary standing,
mm-hmm.
you need to offer 2 sajda of sahv.
Yes.
But the thing that you need to do is to change your niyyah from. Isha to Maghrib,
yes.
from Asr to Dhuhr prayer.
But after the 4th prayer, ruku?
But if you have done the 4th ruku, it means you have already done it. You cannot do anything.
So what can you do? Like you have to finish the...
You have to finish it.
Isha prayer.
Yeah, you have done it because you have already offered the Isha prayer. And after you finish it, you give the salam, then you will need to offer... the Maghrib prayer.
Yes, if there's time. Yes. Okay.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, Sheikh, and then we'll be back. Stay with us.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, here in the studio with us, talking about the prayer rules according to Ayatollah Khamenei. In the earlier part of our program, Sheikh, I asked you a very complicated question. And now let's talk about or think about another scenario, all right?
Good.
That if a person starts the Zuhr prayer, and then while praying, he remembers that he has already offered the Zuhr prayer.
Good.
Okay? So what can he do? Can he change his intention now to the Asr prayer?
No. Ayatollah Khamenei, may Allah grant him long life, is of the view that he cannot change his niyyah from Dhuhr to Asr prayer, you know, because he's already offered the Dhuhr prayer, and a change of niyyah cannot happen. You cannot change your niyyah. Because there's one general point, there's one general criterion that we need to take into consideration. We cannot change our niyyah from ihtiyat to wajib prayer. Mm-hmm. We cannot change our niyyah from wajib to ihtiyat or from wajib to mustahab prayer. We cannot change our niyyah from mustahab to obligatory prayer. Okay, if you are offering, let's say, 2 rakahs of nawafil,
yes,
and you want to change it into 2 rakahs of fajr prayer,
yes,
it's not permissible.
Uh-huh.
But you can change your niyyah from wajib to wajib prayer. Mm-hmm. Now, for example, you are supposed to offer Dhuhr prayer, you are busy offering Asr prayer, okay?
Yes.
And you realize that you have not performed the Dhuhr prayer. You can change your niyyah from the Asr prayer to the noon prayer, but not from the noon to Asr prayer.
So you mean a backward kind of intention changing is possible, but you cannot change your intention forward.
Yeah, forward. Like, uh-huh, you have offered Dhuhr prayer,
yes,
and you realize that you have already offered it,
yes,
and you are busy offering Dhuhr prayer. You want to change it because you are about to finish the prayer, and okay, it's kind of very difficult for you to repeat the Dhuhr to Asr prayer again. You want to change your niyyah from Dhuhr to Asr prayer. That's not permissible.
So what should you do in this case?
Your prayer is wide. Uh-huh. Your prayer is invalid.
So you have to break it then.
You have to stop praying and then offer your Asr prayer from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, fine. Thank you very much for your nice explanation on this. And another question is that, Sheikh, how many rakahs are in the nafla of night or tahajjud prayer?
Well, tahajjud prayer or nawafil, generally speaking, there are many, many nawafil prayers, okay?
Yes.
For example, if we just give a short account of the nawafil prayers, of course, there are 8 rakats in for Dhuhr prayer, which is offered before the Zuhr prayer, and there are 8 rakats of nawafil prayer, which are offered before the Asr prayer. There are 4 rakats of nawafil prayer, which are offered after the Maghrib prayer, and there are also 2 rakats of nawafil prayer, which are offered after Isha prayer, and also there are 2 rakats of nawafil prayer, which are offered, you know, before the Fajr prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So these are, every obligatory prayer has nawafil, okay? There are nawafil prayers with every obligatory prayer. Some are offered like before the prayer, and some are offered after the prayer. Like, for example, the Dhuhr and Asr prayer, the nawafil which come with the Dhuhr and Asr prayer are offered before the main obligatory prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But those which come with the Maghrib and Isha prayer, they are offered after the those two prayers.
I see.
And as far as the nawafil for the Fajr prayer is concerned, it's offered before the before the Fajr prayer. Now, when it comes to the Nawafil, the night Nawafil, or which they call it
the night prayer,
Salat al-Layl, or they call it Salat al-Tahajjud, you know, the word Tahajjud is very commonly, it's better known, you know, in many countries like India and some Muslim countries. So, of course, there are 11 rakats in Tahajjud prayer, or Namaz-e-Shab, or Salat al-Layl, okay? Eight rakats are offered like Fajr prayer. They are offered, all the Nawafil prayers are always offered in twos, in two rakats. So, eight rakats are offered like Fajr prayer.
Yes.
So, you need to offer four prayers, and each prayer has to be offered in two units,
yes,
two rakats. And there's one prayer which is called Salat al-Shafa. Okay, it has a different name,
yes,
and it is offered with the niyyah of Shaf. And then there is also another prayer, one rakat prayer, which is called Salat al-Witr. Witr prayer.
Okay,
Witr prayer consists of one rakat only. And of course, during Witr prayer, you need to pray for mu'mineen, for those whom you know, and that's the last rakat. And these 11 rakats must be offered. There's no must about the obligatory prayers. There's nothing mandatory about the obligatory prayers, okay? When I said must, I mean that it's better for mu'mineen to offer them before the Fajr prayers. And if they don't have time to offer them before the Fajr prayers, of course, they can offer them at any time after Maghrib, after Isha prayers.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh, for your nice contribution. Thank you for listening to us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
In the beginning of April 2011, the Syrian army was ordered to intervene after an increase in armed attacks on security forces in the city of Daraa. But it's safe to say that ordering the army to the streets was a hasty decision, because the intervention of military forces not only did not improve the situation, but also complicated it. What actually happened was the success of the opposition in trying to provoke the people in other parts of Syria and gaining international support. The intervention of the army was good media propaganda to achieve this goal, and the popular networks in the Arab world would regularly broadcast images of heavy weapons entering the cities. And people in contact with these networks would say that armed forces were shooting at the people. Syrian opposition forces.
Part 2.
As the Syrian army was making its efforts to control the crisis, Bashar Assad continued with political reforms. One of the steps he took was issuing a general amnesty to political prisoners. Many of the people who were arrested during and even before the protests were released from prisons. Some of the released prisoners were Salafis who had fought in Iraq and Afghanistan and were in prison because of their membership in terrorist groups. But after their release, many of these people formed extremist Islamist groups against Assad and became senior members of these groups. The release of the Takfiri prisoners and their role in forming Takfiri groups was so effective that later on, Opponents of Bashar Assad accused him of intentionally freeing them. They believe the motive behind the release of the Takfiri prisoners was that by forming Takfiri groups, they could take over the initiative from the secular and moderate opponents of the government. Bashar Assad ordered the release of the prisoners to lessen the attacks of Salafi scholars inside and outside of Syria. And it was obvious that he had no idea of the role they would play in the developments of Syria. At the time, Islamist groups had still not entered the battles in Syria, and opposition forces were trying their best to prevent the conflict from taking on an Islamist position. They believed that talk of the emergence of Islamist leanings in the future Syrian government would scare the West, and they would not allow the formation of an Islamist state which neighbored Israel. The Syrian Muslim Brotherhood, as the most powerful political opposition movement at the time, emphasized on different occasions that it did not seek to establish an Islamic government in Syria. 5 months after the beginning of the protests, on August the 9th of 2011, the King of Saudi Arabia issued a statement which strongly condemned the Syrian government. This statement was the beginning of serious political pressure on Bashar Assad. After this statement, the Saudi ambassador left Damascus, and following that, many countries cut off ties with Syria. At the height of diplomatic pressures on Syria's government, an incident took place in the Arab world which had an effect on Syria's crisis. Libya's revolutionary forces were able to enter the city of Tripoli and brutally killed Muammar Gaddafi. The downfall and death of Gaddafi raised the spirits of the Syrian protesters, who repeatedly promised the same fate for Bashar Assad if he did not step down. The Arab League had a decisive role in the downfall of Gaddafi. It condemned the actions of the Libyan government and army in response to the protests, and had asked the Security Council to stop Gaddafi's actions. The Security Council issued a resolution giving NATO permission to create a no-fly zone over Libya. The intervention of NATO planes changed the balance of power in favor of the opposition. The Libyan army, which had already been weakened because it had delivered its strategic weapons to the West in an attempt to build confidence, was defeated. The cooperation of the Arab League and the Security Council caused the downfall of Gaddafi's rule in less than 6 months. Now the Arab League wanted to use the same successful formula against Bashar Assad. The Arab League suspended Syria's membership and announced that it will send an observer group to Syria and make its final decision based on the group's report. The Arab League appointed a Sudanese general named Mohammed Addabi as the head of the Arab observer group in Syria. Aside from being active in Sudan's military, Mohammed Addabi also had experience in diplomatic efforts, and after retiring from the military, he was Sudan's ambassador to Qatar for years. Mohammed Addabi and his group, which numbers 166, entered Syria on December the 22nd, 2011. During several weeks, they visited different cities which were the scene of clashes. A month later, on the 21st of January, 2012, Mohammed Addabi turned in his report on the situation in Syria to the Secretary General of the Arab League, Nabil El Arabi. But despite expectations, Mohammed Addabi's report was in favor of the Syrian government and told of the attacks of the armed opposition against Syrian forces. In his report, Addabi had emphasized that the Syrian army only targets positions which the armed groups use to attack them, and there was no intention in killing civilians.
Vladimir Putin and former president, current prime minister Medvedev, both of them have noted publicly what a tremendous mistake and blunder of historical proportions it was for Russia and China not to veto UN Security Council Resolution 1973 in Libya. And I think they took this situation in Syria as a, let's call it a second chance, an attempt to redeem themselves.
Before the Russian and Chinese veto of the Security Council resolution, different groups which opposed Bashar Assad were trying to hide their religious leanings. But when it became obvious that the Security Council would not allow NATO's direct involvement in Syria, Bashar Assad's opponents decided to bring down the government by strengthening armed groups and providing them with more weapons. Even though until then, the Free Syrian Army was still the most powerful armed group in Syria, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and Turkey, which were Bashar Assad's most prominent opponents, decided to strengthen Salafi groups. These Salafi groups were more battle-hardened than the Free Syrian Army because of their beliefs and the experience of their participation in the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Prominent Salafi groups, which became the stars of the Syrian crisis in 2012, had only been formed a few months before the end of 2011. But after Saudi Arabia and Qatar changed their policies, they were able to strengthen themselves with the support of these countries. The most prominent Salafi group, which announced its formation only 2 weeks after the veto of the Security Council's resolution, was the Front of the Supporters of the People of the Levant, Syria, or the Nusra Front. The leader of this group was a 31-year-old named Abu Muhammad Julani. Based on unconfirmed reports in 2013, his real name was Ahmad Hussein Ashara, and he was born in 1981 in the village of Ash-Shuhail in the Deir ez-Zor district. His father was a driver for a department in the Syrian army. In 2003, when he was in his second year of college, studying to become a doctor at Damascus University, he left his studies and went to Iraq to fight against U.S. forces and joined Al-Qaeda. In 2006, after the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Julani left Iraq for a short time and went to Lebanon and started to train the Jundah Sham. But after a while, he went back to Iraq to cooperate with Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, the successor of Zarqawi. But the U.S. military arrested him and he was in Buqa prison until 2008. After he was released from prison, Abu Bakr Baghdadi put him in charge of Al-Qaeda's operations in Mosul. A month and a half after the beginning of the protests in Syria, Osama bin Laden was killed by American commandos in Pakistan, and Ayman al-Zawahiri took over the leadership of Al-Qaeda. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi did not accept the new leadership, and the conflict between him and Ayman al-Zawahiri grew. The conflict became worse when Ayman al-Zawahiri pledged allegiance with Mullah Omar, the leader of the Taliban. When the conflict was still not public, Ayman al-Zawahiri called on all fighters across the world to prepare for jihad in Syria. But Abu Bakr Baghdadi took a stance against the leader of Al-Qaeda and announced that jihad in Syria was forbidden. Abu Muhammad Julani and his companions began their operations in the Deir ez-Zor region in the last month of 2011. But the official formation of Nusra Front was in January 2012, and it was accompanied with a number of bombing operations in Damascus. Later on, the group released a number of hostages it had taken with the mediation of the head of Qatar's security apparatus, which showed that not only did a number of commanders, but the entire Qatari government was in direct contact with this group. The next three Salafi jihadi groups, which were effective along with the Nusra Front in 2012, were established by three friends. These three were inmates at Sednaya military prison near Damascus, accused of having ties with terrorist groups. The most famous one was Zahran Alush. He was the son of a famous Syrian Salafi named Sheikh Abdullah Alush.
After learning the basics of religious studies from his father, he went to Saudi Arabia and attended the classes of the most prominent Salafi scholars at the Islamic University of Medina, such as Sheikh Abdullah bin Baz. After Alush returned to Syria, he began religious and promotional activities. At the end of 2009, Zahran Alush was arrested by Syrian security forces because of his ties with terrorist groups. But after a year and a half, he was released from prison after a general amnesty was issued. After being released from prison, Alush and a number of like-minded people set up a group called Sariat al-Islam in the city of Douma. In Arabic, Sariyah is what the smallest military unit is called. But Zahran Alush was quickly able to increase his forces. He was able to attract smaller groups which were not able to generate a lot of financial and logistical support from foreigners.
And I am confident, you know.
Because of Zahran Alush's history with Saudi Arabia, the group he commanded was supported by Bandar bin Sultan, the then head of Saudi Arabia's intelligence agency.
Well, it has funded various rebel groups, no question. And that's the way the Saudis have proceeded. They have not committed their own forces, but they have provided arms, money, ammunition to the rebel groups that they had confidence in.
The third prominent Salafi group, which was formed at the end of 2011 in Syria, was Ahrar al-Sham, which was established by another one of the released prisoners of Sadnaya military prison. His name was Hassan Aboud. He was born in the city of Hama. He became acquainted with Salafi groups when he was studying English in the city of Aleppo. And he was in prison because of his activities within these groups. After his release from prison, he set up a battalion named Ahrar al-Sham with another group of released prisoners in the Hama region. In the beginning of 2012, messengers from Ayman al-Zawahiri supported this group. With the interference of Al-Qaeda, the Islamic Fajr movement and other smaller movements joined the group, and Ahrar al-Sham officially began its activities. The movement was very capable because it was well-equipped and well-resourced. It was able to carry out many operations against the Syrian army. During this period, Abu Khalid Suri was in charge of planning the organizational chart and training of the Ahrar al-Sham movement. Abu Khalid Suri was a close acquaintance of Osama bin Laden and among the people trusted by Ayman al-Zawahiri. He had fought in the wars in Chechnya, Bosnia, Afghanistan, and Iraq, and because of his experience, he was respected by the leadership council of Ahrar al-Sham. With the establishment and expansion of these Salafi groups, little by little, support for secular groups decreased, and those who were supposed to take over power in Syria were now being ignored by the countries that used to support them because of the veto of the Security Council's resolution. The amount of support for Islamist groups was so great that even the Free Syrian Army thought of forming Salafi armed groups. Even though the group introduced itself as a secular group without ethnic and religious leanings, from this period on, it set up Salafi Islamist battalions to be able to get a share of the money that was coming in from the countries of the Persian Gulf region. The most important Islamist group affiliated with the Syrian army was the Tawhid Brigade, which was made up of 29 small Islamist groups, and it was established in the Aleppo region. The commander of the Tawhid Brigade was Abdul Qadir Saleh. After the establishment of these groups, a wave of volunteers from different parts of the world went to Syria. During this process, Salafi scholars had a determining role in encountering young Sunnis to go to Syria. The interesting part was the change in the position that prominent scholars took when it came to Bashar Assad. For example, Sheikh Yusuf Abdullah Al-Qardawi, who was the chairman of the International Union of Muslim Scholars, had visited Syria many times before the crisis began and was a supporter of Bashar Assad. But after the political change in Qatar when it came to Syria, Sheikh Qardawi suddenly changed his position. Many of the people who would travel to Syria for jihad were controlled by the security services of their countries because of the way they thought and communicated, but these security systems did not prevent them from going to Syria. Even in some European countries, some mosques had turned into headquarters to organize and send young people to Syria. But the security forces in these countries did not prevent these people from traveling to Syria. It seemed they were following a policy that the exit of these people from their country would improve their own national security. Some European media organizations would even broadcast reports that showed the humanitarian efforts of groups affiliated to Al-Qaeda. Foreign fighters would go to Turkey and Lebanon and from there be transferred into Syria. The Turkish government had given the Salafi groups free passage and did not create any obstacles in their transfer via unofficial border passages. But in Lebanon, things were a bit different. The Lebanese government had announced its neutrality in the Syrian crisis, but from the very beginning, the political group, the March 14 Alliance, began to actively support armed opposition groups in Syria. At the time, among the political parties of the March 14 Alliance, the Future Movement, led by Saad Hariri, would provide the most help to the opposition groups in Syria. Even though the Future Movement constantly insisted that its support for armed groups in Syria was merely spiritual in nature, the Daily Al-Akhbar printed a recording of a call by a Future Movement PM named Okab Sakr, which showed that this political group provides a part of the weapons that Salafi groups use in Syria. A few days later, during a press conference, Okab Sakr attacked those who had reported the conversation and said the movement is only sending humanitarian aid to Syria. Later on, unarmed opponents of Bashar Assad revealed that the Future Movement had made suggestions to them that in exchange for money and weapons, they take up arms against Bashar Assad's government.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked.
The Holy Prophet of Islam is the example.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. Stay tuned.
Thank you. حضرت سلمان تو مدائن استاندار بود، حاکم مدائن بود.
When Salman al-Farsi was the governor of Madain, he heard that one of the good companions of Imam Ali alayhi salam by the name of Zayd ibn Suhan is attentive to his spiritual training and takes little care about the affairs of his house. Upon hearing this, Salman went to the house of Zayd and knocked on his door. Zayd's wife opened the door and told Salman that Zayd and his friends are attending a spiritual gathering inside the mosque. Salman asked Zayd's wife to cook a small food. He then took the food to the mosque. When reaching the mosque, Salman asked Zayd to come out of the mosque and eat the food, but Zayd refused because he was fasting. For the second time, and in a strict manner, Salman asked Zayd to break his fast and eat the food. Zayd asked Salman about the reason for his strictness and insistence on breaking the fast with the food.
سلمان گفت پیغمبر زاهدترین شخص تو عالم وجود بوده.
سلمان replied, you can't find any person more ascetic and pious than Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wa sallam. Still, he was always with his family and taking care of the affairs of his house. Now Zayd, you want to become a spiritual wayfarer and put all the hardships on the shoulder of your wife and family? This is not the path towards perfection. You better sit down and eat your food and then go to your house and help your wife and children. From this answer of Salman al-Farsi to Zayd ibn Suhan, we understand that spiritual perfection, depending on your situation, is not necessarily achieved in the mosque and religious gatherings, but can be reached inside one's house too. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Hujjatul Islam Ali. To find out more about this program, log on to our website, www.parstoday.com, Call of Islam page. We'll leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge. We are discussing about the topic of the Charter of Islamic Governance based on the teachings of Imam Ali alayhi salam in Nahjul Balagha. We are basing our discussions on sermon number 3, also known as the Sermon of Sheikh Shaqiyya. And we reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam explains about the purpose of Islamic governance, and that is to establish justice and to fight and to ward off injustice. He says, وَمَا أَخَذَ اللَّهُ عَلَى الْعُلَمَاءِ أَنْ لَا يُقَارُوا عَلَى كِضَّةِ ظَالِمٍ وَلَا سَغَبِ مَظْلُومٍ. That we have taken a covenant, that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has taken a covenant from the people of knowledge, that they cannot remain indifferent in the face of the oppression of the oppressors, especially when the oppressors are all, you know, you can say, filled with blessings and filled with material opportunities of all forms in terms of economy, knowledge, studies, whatever. While there are a group of oppressed people who don't have the opportunity to even study, to even learn, to even progress the least. So Imam Ali says this is a very big inequality, and whenever such an inequality happens, it is the people of knowledge that have to come in the scene and sort this issue.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, when Imam Ali alayhi salam came into power, and especially when the reason why he comes into power, basically, he sees that the society the social justice, the social injustices that are happening in the community cannot be alleviated except through power and force. When there is a power on top, through governance, through authority. Because for all these years, he tried to give his guidance and consultation from afar. And, you know, through advice and through preaching. But that didn't work. You know, nowadays there are these people that say that, you know, let the people of religion, let the book of God, and let those people who are, you can say, the ones who take care of the books of God, let them just guide the community from afar and not interfere in the issue of governance. Imam Ali alayhi salam saying that this is not possible for the people of knowledge, because through advice and through consultations and through all of these, you can say, indirect methods of guiding, things are not working. People are not changing, and the social injustices are even increasing. So what was the solution? The solution was Imam Ali had to come to power. And that is what Imam Ali alayhi salam is saying, that this covenant of God that is upon the people of knowledge, that they cannot remain indifferent. They have to take steps. They have to take action in solving the problems of the society. Today we see the same. Today look at the issue that we are facing. Yes, in the apparent sense, when you look at the technology and the industrial progress, all of that, it is mind-boggling. But at the same time, if you look at the destruction of the moral fabric of the society, it is really shocking, and it is at times even disgusting. We look at the world today. In different parts of the world, you see bodies that are filled with blood due to the oppression that is going on. Look at those weak people of the society. They are being crushed by those who are powerful. Okay? Look at the poverty. Look at the inequality that exists in certain countries, in certain places where people are living in huge palaces, big villas, and at the same time, just outside the city, people are living in slums in the worst conditions possible. Look at this inequality.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, when we talk about inequality in the world of today, you will find different examples. Okay? Look at the hunger, only the hunger that exists in the world today. There are some parts of the world where people are literally dying of hunger. People cannot eat food. When there was a huge crisis in Ethiopia where people were dying of hunger, alright? At that time, there were people there were communities, there were countries that had so much food that they were throwing the food into the oceans just to maintain the balance of the price of those food materials, while people were dying of hunger in other parts of the world. This is the level of you can say, the inequality that exists today. It's just a matter of skimming through the pages of history to see what had happened in the past in terms of the colonial establishments and what the colonized countries were going through. And today, of course, the colonial rulers of the past that are still present today would never like to hear this part of history, and they are trying their best to make the nations forget the colonial legacy. But it is important for us to always keep that alive through conferences, through gatherings, reminding people about the reality of the proud and arrogant and cruel establishments of the world of today. And now we are in front of Imam Ali alayhi salam here, and he's addressing all of the people of knowledge. That, O people of knowledge, or those who have learnt, those who have studied, who have understood the reality, it is your duty to stand up towards justice, to bridge this gap. We cannot accept this as people of knowledge, to see that there are people who are dying of hunger in one side of the world, and on the other side people are enjoying so much food that they're throwing three quarters of what is on their tables. This is really something that cannot be tolerated. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He brings closer the reappearance of the 12th Holy Imam, so that He takes out these injustices and brings the government of justice on this world. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال مناه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With the light.
Swimming in sub-zero temperatures can be unimaginable for most people, but not for a group of athletes who've tested their skills and strength in Prague's Vltava River. 360 people from 8 countries gathered in the Czech capital to participate in an annual winter swimming event. The air temperature was minus 6 degrees Celsius, with water temperatures dipping to as low as 3 degrees. The event honors Alfred Nikodem, a Czech swimmer who braved the frigid waters in Prague for the first time in 1923, starting a tradition that has been kept alive ever since. Now the world's most powerful observatory is finally on its million-kilometer journey after several technical delays. The NASA telescope named James Webb blasted off into orbit on Saturday, heading to an outpost that's 1.5 million kilometers away from Earth. The observatory was in the making for some 3 decades and cost about $10 billion. It left Earth enclosed in a rocket and from a launch pad in South America. The journey will last a month. The telescope is the size of a tennis court. And if everything goes according to plan, it will enter service in June. Astronomers are hoping they can learn more about the origins of the universe once it starts beaming back new clues. A school in Spain is offering students an opportunity to join a special orchestra. The project dubbed The Music of Recycling brings unwanted junk back to life by transforming them into musical instruments. And here is how they sound. The project offers the instruments to the orchestra in one of Madrid's most disadvantaged neighborhoods. The students say the orchestra keeps them away from mischief and out of serious trouble while giving them an artistic outlet. Several dozens of children are taking music classes from members of the orchestra as part of the project. The ensemble has put on several concerts across Spain, but because of the pandemic, they had to pause their performances. The project is run by a Spanish environmental group and is inspired by a similar orchestra in Paraguay. To most people, an eggshell is something that gets tossed in the garbage. But to one Chinese artist, the delicate eggshell is the chosen canvas to express art and create mini masterpieces. Zhu is a talented craftsman who has created a series of unique egg sculptures with the theme of Beijing's Winter Olympic and Paralympic Games. Icons of ice and snow sports, as well as etchings of the 2022 Olympic mascots, are showcased in this series. The thin and delicate texture of the shells adds to the difficulty of the craft, which creates a sense of fragile beauty. Zhu says his fascination with eggshell art started when he was very young.
The Christmas season is when people around the world left out a dose of joy in the form of Santas. But it's different in central Thailand on this Christmas Eve. Thai children were ecstatic to see Santa Claus's distributing presents, but this time, in the shape of elephants. Dressed in Santa costumes, five elephants carried dolls, face masks, and sanitizers for students. They were surrounded by many human Santa Clauses as well. But the students cheered with joy while reaching out for presents from the jumbos. Event managers say their goal was to encourage students to stay vigilant during the pandemic. Plus, they wanted to give the children some fun to look forward after months of virtual classes. The event is a yearly highlight for a school that caters to students from kindergarten to secondary level.
Scientists have made a stunning discovery inside a fossilized dinosaur egg, an embryo that's been preserved in a perfect shape. The embryo was found inside a 66 million year old fossil in a museum in the Chinese city of Guangzhou. Paleontologists say it's the best dinosaur embryo ever found. They're hoping it would help a lot in finding the links between modern birds and dinosaurs. The fossil belongs to a toothless Oviraptorosaur, a group of feathered dinosaurs that used to live in what's now Asia and North America. The embryo is nicknamed Baby Yinliang after the Chinese museum that houses the fossil.
After almost 2 years of isolation due to the coronavirus pandemic, Mexicans are once again celebrating Christmas together in a fair in the capital, Mexico City. Here's more.
It is a joy that we've been planning for a long time to go out and to take this picture because we've been locked up for 2 years and we couldn't go out. Now there's green light. We decided to go out with the whole family to live these moments together.
A few things are different in the fair as far as Mexican tradition goes. Santa, and not the traditional three wise men, give out presents. Families also have their photos taken by the Father Christmas. These are rare moments amid the coronavirus pandemic. The attendees say the situation is complicated, but they will try their best to make it work. The festival has been made possible by the introduction of green passes, which indicate full vaccination against COVID.
Exchanging gifts is an inseparable and also the most joyful part of Christmas traditions. How about sharing the joy with animals? Now, a zoo in the Colombian city of Cali is doing so by giving presents to its animals. The presents are actually the animals' favorite foods served in a different way. Animals spend time unpacking the gifts decorated in Christmas theme and then access the food they like the most. Feeding in this way arouses the animals' curiosity and fills them with excitement. Zookeepers say they want to show that animals always receive care at their zoo.
It is a very cool way to generate empathy for visitors. Although animals do not know that it's Christmas or that it's a special date, it is important to generate that message in visitors that we make care of our animals, and that for us it is important to share with them this Christmas season.
The zookeepers say they make use of enrichment strategies for their initiative. They actually stimulate the behaviors of a range of animals, even the species they keep in an aquarium. Running a marathon is pretty tough for most, but a group of people has upped the ante to take the competition